of an artisan's former workshop, heading south toward relative safety. Anastasius snorted again, but again he refrained from further comment. He'd been through this dance with Belisarius so many times that he had long since given up hope of teaching new steps to his general. One of the other cataphracts, new to the job, was not so philosophical. "For Christ's sake, Isaac," he whispered to his companion. "The general could lounge on the docks for all the army cares. Be happier if he did, in fact." Isaac shrugged.
"Yeah, Priscus, that's what I think, too. But maybe that's why he's Rome's best general. Best ever, if you ask me. And we're spear chuckers."
Priscus's response, whatever it might have been, was buried beneath the sounds of grenades exploding a few dozen yards behind them. The Malwa were beginning a new assault. Seconds later, the shouts of charging men were blended with musket fire and more grenade explosions. And then, within a half a minute, came the first sounds of steel meeting steel. The cataphracts did not look back. Not once, in all the time it took them, guarding Belisarius, to clamor through the rubbled streets and shattered buildings, which were all that days of Roman demolition and Malwa shelling had left of Carax's centered district. Not until they finally reached the relatively undamaged harbor which made up the city's southern area did the cataphracts turn and look back to the north. "Besides," said Isaac, renewing their conversation, "what are you complaining about anyway?" He thrust his beard northward. "Would you rather be back there again, fighting street to street?" Priscus grimaced. Like Isaac, he'd become Belisarius' bodyguard only a few days before. The initial pair of bodyguards whom Morris had selected to replace Valentinian had been replaced themselves after the siege of Carax began. Morris, determined to keep Belisarius alive, had made his final selection based on the most cold-blooded reasoning possible. Whichever soldiers among the Bucellarii could demonstrate in days of savage battle in the streets of Carax that they were the most murderous, got the job. Isaac and Priscus had been at the top of the list. They had earned that position in one of the most brutal tests ever devised by the human race. Neither of them had heard of Stalingrad, nor would they ever. But either of them, planted among the veterans of Chuikov's 62nd Army, would have felt quite at home. Language barriers be damned.
"Good point," muttered Priscus.
He turned along with Isaac and plodded after Belisarius. The general was heading toward the heavy-walled warehouse where the Roman army had set up its headquarters. Priscus eyed the figure of his tall general stooping into a small door.
"At least he's got the good sense to leave before the blades get wet."
"So far," grunted Isaac.
He tugged at one of the straps holding up his heavy cataphract gear.
"Damn, I'm sick of walking around in this armor."
The cataphracts plodded on a few more steps. As they came to the door, Isaac repeated,
"So far, but don't get your hopes up. 2 weeks from now, three at the outside, the Malwa will have reached the harbor. You know what'll happen when that day comes."
Priscus scowled.
"Sallies, lance charges, the whole bit, with the general right in the middle of it. We'll wish Valentinian were here then."
On that gloomy note, the two cataphracts stooped and forced their armored way through a door designed for midgets. The door led into what seemed to be a 6-foot-long tunnel in the massive wall of the warehouse. The effort of that passage left them practically snarling. 5 minutes later, they were smiling like cherubs. Chapter 37. As soon as Belisarius straightened after squeezing through the narrow passage, he saw Boozies rushing toward him. Except for a well-lit area against the far wall, where Belisarius had set up his writing desk and map table, the interior of the cavernous warehouse was dark. Boozies was in such a hurry that he tripped over some debris lying on the floor and wound up stumbling into Belisarius's arms.
"Easy there, easy," chuckled Belisarius.
He set Boozies back up straight.
"Things can't be that bad."
Boozies muttered a quick apology, then pointing toward a door on the opposite wall. "Morris says you've got to go up and see something. He told me to tell you as soon as you arrived." Belisarius' brow was creased just slightly.
"What's the problem?"
Boozies shook his head.
"Don't know. Morris wouldn't tell me anything else, but he was very emphatic about it."
Belisarius strode toward the door.
Behind him, he heard the heavy footsteps of his armored cataphracts following. The door, like the one he had just passed through, was low and narrow. Again, Belisarius had to stoop to pass through. Except for the huge doors designed for freight, the entire warehouse seemed to have been built by dwarves. Once through the door, he clambered up a wooden staircase leading to the roof. As quickly as Belisarius was moving, the effort of negotiating the steep and narrow stairs was considerable, even for a man in his excellent condition and wearing only half armor. He felt a moment's sympathy for his cataphract bodyguards. They'd be huffing by the time they made the same climb. The staircase debouched into a small chamber. Again, Belisarius squeezed through a tiny door and emerged into open air. Behind him, the northern wall of the warehouse reared up like a battlement. Ahead of him, the brick roof, braced underneath by heavy beams, formed a flat expanse stretching toward the sea. He could see the delta glistening under a midday sun. Belisarius had selected this warehouse for his headquarters because of its odd design. At one time, he suspected the north wall of the building had been the outer wall of Carax. It was built like a fortification, at least, which might explain the tiny doors. When Carax expanded and new walls were built, some enterprising merchant had simply built his warehouse against the 6-foot-thick northern wall. The end result, so far as the Roman general was concerned, was as good a field headquarters as he could ask for. The massive north wall gave some protection from artillery, while at the same time, the flat roof provided him with a perfect vantage point from which to observe the delta. He saw Morris standing on the southern edge of the roof. There was no railing to keep someone from pitching over the side onto the docks 30 feet below, but Morris seemed unconcerned. The Kiliarch had apparently heard the squeaking of the door, for he was already looking at Belisarius when the general emerged onto the roof. "Come here," he hollered, holding up the telescope. "There's a new development I think you should consider." Belisarius hurried over. As he made his way across the 50-foot-wide expanse, he quickly scanned the entire area. From the roof, he could see all of southern Carax, as well as the Great Delta, which extended southward to the Persian Gulf itself, perhaps 10 miles away. Carax had been built on the east bank of the largest tributary, which formed the Tigris-Euphrates Delta, on a spit extending south and west of the Mesopotamian mainland. The tributary could hardly be called a river. It was so broad that it was almost a small gulf in its own right. For all practical purposes, Carax was a port city which was surrounded by water from the west all the way around to its east by southeast quadrant. His eyes scanned right, then left. He could see nothing that would cause Morris such apparent concern. There were masses of Malwa troops on both banks of the tributary, but they had been there since the first few days of the siege. The Malwa had tried to position siege guns on those banks, where they could have fired into the harbor area, but had given up the effort after a week. The ground, as the reeds which covered the banks indicated, was much too soggy. The troops were there simply to keep the Romans from escaping, while the main forces of the Malwa tried to hammer their way into the city from the north. They also kept the galleys patrolling the delta supplied with provisions. He turned his eyes to the fore, looking for the galleys. Again, he could see nothing amiss. There had been upwards of 20 galleys stationed in Carax when Belisarius broke into the city. Half of them had been on patrol, and all but 3 of the ones moored to the docks had managed to get free before Roman troops could seize them. Since then, the Malwa had used the galleys to maintain a blockade. Belisarius's obvious escape route was to sail out on the cargo ships he had captured, but there was no way to get those ungainly vessels through a line of war galleys. The huge Malwa cargo ships might have been able to withstand ramming, some of them, at least, but the galleys were armed with rockets as well as rams. At close range, with no room to maneuver, rocket valleys would turn unarmored cargo ships into floating funeral pyres. As it was, Belisarius's soldiers had been hard-pressed to extinguish the small conflagrations started on the moored ships by long-range rocket fire. Link was making no pretense of saving the cargo ships to evacuate the Malwa troops. Even though the vast majority of the rockets never came close to the docks, the galleys, as well as the troops stationed on the banks, had kept up a steady barrage since the beginning of the siege. Belisarius didn't want to think about the disciplinary measures which Link must be taking to keep its troops driving forward into what, by now, even the dimwits among them must have realized was a suicide mission. "I'm sure that Link has promised the Yetai commanders that Malwa would save the Yetai if the barbarians kept the regular troops under control." Belisarius agreed with Aide's assessment, But as he advanced toward Morris, Belisarius could still see nothing in the delta to cause any concern. Outside of three galleys moored to a makeshift pier on the east bank, taking on supplies, the rest were on patrol. As usual, the Malwa kept five galleys close to the harbor, with the remainder spread out between 1 and 2 miles away. When he came up to Morris, the gray-haired Kiliarch was studying the galleys themselves. His expression seemed one of grim satisfaction.
"They haven't seen it yet," he said. "Our elevation's better."
He handed Belisarius the telescope. Grim satisfaction was replaced by... Before he even got the telescope up, in a motion so quick he almost gave himself a black eye, Belisarius knew. He only heard Morris's next words dimly through the rushing blood in his ears.
"Yeah, I thought you'd want to see it, lad. It's not often, after all, that a man gets to watch Venus rise from the waves."
Belisarius saw the glint before he spotted the masts. He'd been looking for sails until he realized there wouldn't be any. This close to their final destination, the Ethiopian warships would be advancing under oar. But there was no doubt of what he was seeing. Belisarius wasn't a seaman, but he could tell the difference between a warship and a cargo vessel at a glance. The 12 vessels whose masts he could see, perhaps 10 miles away, were obviously fighting craft. And he had enough experience, with perhaps a minute's study, to be able to distinguish the upper structure of an Aksumite warship from a Malwa galley. "They're ours, all right," he muttered happily. "No doubt about it. But..." He brought the telescope back to the lead ship in the oncoming flotilla. There it was again. Something glinting. He pulled the telescope away from his eye, frowning. Not worried, simply puzzled. "There's something odd." Morris nodded.
"You spotted it too? Something shining on and off on the lead ship?"
The Kiliarch's eyes fixed on the horizon.
"I saw it myself. First thing I spotted, in fact. Still haven't been able to figure out what it is. Might be a mirror, I suppose, if Antonina wanted to signal..."
Both men simultaneously realized the truth, and both simultaneously burst into laughter.
"Well, of course," shouted Morris gaily. "She's Venus, isn't she? Naturally, she's got the biggest damn brass tits in the world."
Belisarius said nothing coherent until he stopped leaping about in a manner which was halfway between a drunken jig and a war dance. Then, before the astonished eyes of the cataphract bodyguards who had finally puffed their way onto the roof, the strategos of the Roman Empire and the commander of its finest army, normally as cool as ice in the face of the enemy, began taunting the distant Malwa troops like an 8-year-old boy in a schoolyard.
"That's my lady! That's my lady!"
was the only one of those expressions which was not so gross, so obscene, so foul, so vile, and so vulgar that Satan's minions would have fled in horror, taloned paws clasped over bat-ugly ears. In the hours which followed, as Morris and Vasudeva organized the escape from Carax, Belisarius paid no attention to the doings of his army. There was no need for him to do so, of course. The plans for the escape had been made weeks before Carax was even seized. Ever since the Romans had taken the city, a large portion of the soldiers had been working like beavers to get ready for departure. The cargo ships were loaded with provisions. The city was mined for final destruction. All that remained to be done was drive out the horses, collect the civilians, and organize the fighting retreat back to the docks. The horses were driven out within the first 2 hours. Released from their holding corrals near the docks, the panicked creatures were driven through broken streets toward the Malwa lines. It was a task which the Roman soldiers carried out with reluctance, but perhaps for that reason, as quickly as possible. Most of the horses would die, they knew. Many would be killed by the Malwa themselves, either because they were mistaken for a cavalry charge, or simply from being struck by stray missiles or grenades. Others would break their legs clambering through the rubble. Most of the horses who escaped the city, except for those captured by the Malwa, would probably die of starvation in the desert and swamps beyond. And even those horses which found themselves in the relative safety of Malwar captivity would, in all likelihood, be eaten by the Malwar troops as they themselves became desperate for food. But the only alternative was to destroy them along with the city. There was absolutely no way to load them aboard the cargo ships. Transporting large numbers of horses by sea was a difficult enough task under the best of circumstances. It would be impossible for an army making a hurried escape under enemy fire. Given the alternatives, the Romans would drive the horses out. Some would survive in the desert, after all, long enough to be captured by Bedouin. So, at least, Belisarius had explained the matter to his troops. And so far as it went, the explanation was not dishonest. But the general's ultimate reason for the choice hadn't been humanitarian. When he needed to be, Belisarius could be as ruthless as any man alive. He knew full well that as soon as Link discovered that enemy warships were approaching Carax, it would understand finally the full extent of Belisarius's plan. At which point, Link would order an all-out, frenzied assault on Carax, driving the Malwar troops forward as if they were beasts themselves. Stampeding herds of horses meeting those incoming human herds would create as much confusion as possible, confusion which would delay the Malwa advance and give the escaping Romans that much greater a chance to save their own lives. It took even less time to organize the evacuation of the civilians. The civilians were all women. There had been a handful of male Persian civilians when the Romans took the city. Within a day, after the women told their tales, they had been executed along with the Malwa soldiers with whom they had collaborated. The female civilians had been warned days in advance and now were being rounded up. But there was hardly any rounding up to do. Since the Romans had arrived and freed them from Malwa's subjugation, none of Carax's women had strayed more than a few yards away from a Roman soldier at any time of the day or night. That was from their own choice, not coercion. They had been like half-drowned kittens, desperately clutching a log for survival. As poor women thrust into such a wretched state have done throughout history, the survivors of Malwa Carax had become camp followers of the Roman army. Depending on their age, appearance, and temperament, they had become concubines, cooks, laundresses, nurses, more often than not, all of those combined. And if their current status was dismal by abstract standards, it seemed like a virtual paradise to them. The Roman soldiers, crude as they might be, were rarely brutal to their women. Belisarius's soldiers, at least. Other Roman armies might have been, but between Belisarius's discipline, to which they had long been accustomed, and their own horror at Malwa bestiality, the soldiers had conducted themselves in a manner which might almost be called chivalrous. So long, of course, as the term chivalrous is understood to include vulgarity, coarse humor, the unthinking assumption that the women would feed them, clean up after them, and do the washing, and, needless to say, an instant readiness to copulate using any means short of outright rape. In truth, the social position of most of the women was no worse than it had been before the Malwa invasion. More licentious, true. But there was this by way of compensation. The new men in their lives had proven themselves to be tough enough to give those women a real chance for survival. That is no small thing in the vortex of a raging war. Belisarius, through his officers, had already told the women that they would be reunited with whatever families they might still have. But not to his surprise, the majority had made clear that they would just as soon remain camp followers of his army, wherever it went. The difficulty in evacuating the women, therefore, was not in collecting them. Those women who could move were gathered on the docks sooner than anyone else. The problem was that even weeks after the liberation of Carax, many of the women could not move. At least a third of the women who had been enslaved in the military brothels were still too weak or sick to move under their own power. Their evacuation posed a major medical undertaking. That evacuation took 3 hours before all the litters were carried aboard the ships. In the end, only 12 women were left behind, in the medical ward set aside for the most badly abused slaves. All of them were unconscious and so close to death that moving them seemed impossible. The Roman officer in charge of evacuating that medical ward danced back and forth, fretful and indecisive. A nurse, who had herself been chained in one of the brothels, whispered to a Kushan soldier. He handed her his dagger. The nurse, cold-faced, ordered everyone out of the ward using a tone which Empress Theodora would have approved. When she emerged 5 minutes later, her face was calm, her manner relaxed. She had even taken the time to clean the dagger. All that remained was the fighting retreat of the soldiers holding the front lines. Under any circumstances in the world other than the one in which he found himself, Belisarius would have overseen that retreat personally. His bodyguards would have been driven half insane from the risks he would have taken, but today... Morris didn't even bother to discuss it with Belisarius. He simply carried out the task himself. The work wasn't beyond his capability, after all. In truth, Morris probably led that retreat as well as Belisarius could have. And there was an added advantage, at least to the soldiers who served as Morris's bodyguards. The grizzled veteran had a proper understanding of the proper place of a proper commanding officer in the middle of a battle. Thank you. So, in one of history's little ironies, the military genius who led what was arguably, up to that day, the most daring and brilliant campaign of all time, played no role in its dramatic conclusion. Never even noticed it, in truth. Instead, his eye glued to a telescope, the general found himself undergoing a brand new experience. He knew abstractly of the anguish Antonina had always undergone whenever he went off to war, and he had chuckled, hearing the tales from Morris and Irene afterward, of the way Antonina spent the day after his departure. He was chuckling no longer. Belisarius, watching his wife wage a battle at sea right under his eyes, but beyond his reach or control, finally understood what it meant. To stare at a horse. Chapter 38.
Stay down, Antonina, grumbled Usanas.
The Akabe-sensen looked to Matthew and pointed at the woman forcing her head past his elbow.
Sit on her if you have to.
Matthew flushed. Then, gingerly, advanced his great paws toward Antonina's shoulders. Antonina gave him a quick glare. For a moment, Matthew retreated, but only for a moment. The inexorable clasp of unwanted protection returned.
All right, snapped Antonina.
She stepped back perhaps half an inch.
Peevishly, now are you satisfied?
No, came the immediate response. I want you down, fool woman, any minute now.
A stretched-out shriek drew Usanas's eyes back to the front. Through a narrow slit in the flagship's bow shield, he could see the first volley of rockets heading their way from the line of Malwa galleys ahead.
And now has come.
He stepped back two paces, pushing Antonina behind him. With a little wave, he gestured Gersom forward. Wasi's successor stepped up to the slit where he could see well enough to guide the battle.
Remember, Gersom, said Usanas. All that matters is to destroy the galleys, whatever the cost. If need be, even if ours are destroyed, we can find a place on Belisarius's ships.
The new Dekuan commander nodded. A moment later, the sound of the first rocket volley came hissing by overhead. As soon as the missiles went past the bow shield, Usanas and Antonina craned their heads to watch their flight.
Way too long, muttered Usanas. But they've all been fitted with Venturi. Let's hope the shields stand up.
He brought his eyes down to the short Roman woman standing next to him.
They will not have you dead when Belisarius comes aboard this ship, Usanas said. Not that, whatever else.
We might all...
Usanas clapped his hands. An instant later, as helpless as a doll, Antonina was lowered onto the deck. Matthew and Leo each held an arm and a leg. Their grip on her was as delicate as possible under the circumstances, but Antonina wasn't mollified. The entire process was accompanied by her own monologue.
You're dismissed. Discharged, do you hear?
Was the only one of her spluttering phrases which was not so vituperative, so vindictive, so intemperate, and so utterly foul-mouthed that Usanas howled with laughter, clasping his hands over his belly. Once her butt had been firmly planted on the deck, Antonina broke off her tirade and glared up at Usanas.
You think this is funny? She demanded.
Still laughing, Usanas nodded. An instant later... Even in her outrage, Antonina was stunned by the speed with which Usanas could move without seemingly any warning or effort. The Akabe-sensen was sitting right next to her. He beamed down upon her from a height which was now only measured in inches instead of feet.
Hysterically so, he pronounced.
His next words were drowned under the sound of another rocket volley screaming overhead. Again, he and Antonina craned their necks, watching the rocket's trajectory.
"Can't see where they hit," complained Antonina, scowling. "Can't see anything in this ridiculous position."
Usanas's grin returned.
"Which," he said with satisfaction, "is the whole point. You don't need to see where they hit. And if you can't see the rockets when they hit, we can hope they will return the favor."
Antonina's scowl, if anything, deepened.
"That's the stupidest thing I ever heard.
Those rockets will go wherever they want to. You watch." Deep, deep scowl.
"Except we won't be able to watch because we can't see a damn thing, so the rockets will catch us by surprise and..."
The next volley of rockets caught them by surprise. The Mulga, apparently, had adjusted the angle of the rocket troughs perched in the bows of the oncoming galleys. The first signal of incoming fire which Antonina and Usanas received was the sudden boom of rockets smashing into the bow shield and caroming off to either side. They only caught glimpses of the missiles streaking past. Perhaps 2 seconds later, they heard the erupting warheads. Both of them knew from the sound alone that the rockets had exploded harmlessly in midair. Antonina's displeasure vanished instantly.
"Beautiful," she cried. "Beautiful."
She squirmed onto her knees, raising her head high enough to be able to see over the side of the ship. Usanas made no objection. He even gave Matthew and Leo, squatting nearby, a reassuring little wave of the hand. The essence of the gesture was clear.
"As long as the fool woman doesn't stick her head and her brass tits out where any Malwa can take a shot at her."
Antonina's lips were pursed now with a faint worry.
"One problem, though. I hadn't thought about it."
She pointed forward.
"We sure enough protect against bow shots, but the ricochets might hit one of the ships alongside. There isn't any shielding covering most of the ships."
Usanna shrugged.
"No matter, Antonina. Luck, good or bad, will happen as it will."
The bow shield bellied again under the impact of a new rocket volley. Again, the boom, almost like a drum, and again, two missiles caromed by, and again, exploded harmlessly over the waves. Antonina, scanning right and left as she stared toward the stern of the flagship, was relieved by what she saw. The Ethiopian ship captains had already recognized the same danger and were responding. Karax's delta was several miles wide, giving plenty of sea room. The Aksumite ships, advancing in a single line, were already spreading out. Antonina watched several more rockets bounce off the shields on other ships and skitter past the entire formation. The angle of the shields, she realized, was so acute that only the worst possible luck could cause a rocket to carom sideways.
"The main thing,"
Usanas continued, unlike Antonina, he hadn't bothered to watch the trajectories,
"is that almost all the incoming rockets will be harmless. Once we get in ramming range, they'll stop firing."
He chuckled grimly.
"Not even a fanatic Mahaveda priest will want to be in the bow of a ship plunging in for a ram."
Antonina turned back and hunkered lower. She studied the figure of Gersom in the bow. The new Dekuan commander, still peering intently through a slit in the shield, suddenly seemed very young. Usanas apparently could read minds.
"Relax. I picked him even though he's the most junior of the sub-officers because he's also the best seaman."
"Says who?" demanded Antonina. "You know as much about boats as I do about..."
"Says all the other sub-officers," came the serene reply.
Usanas stretched out his arms, pointing to the Aksumite ships ranging alongside them to both port and starboard.
"That's true on all of them. Existing commanders, of course, weren't replaced. But until the boarding starts, command of each of those ships is in the hands of the most capable captain. Rank be damned."
Mention of boarding focused Antonina's mind elsewhere. She turned and smiled sweetly at Matthew.
"I forgive you. Now please bring me my gun."
It was Usanas's turn to scowl.
"What do you need that thing for?" he demanded. "You aren't going to be storming across any decks."
Antonina shook her head.
"Certainly not."
Again, she smiled sweetly.
"Whole idea's absurd, unladylike."
Matthew returned with his mission accomplished. Antonina cradled the monstrous weapon like a beloved child.
"But you never know," she said serenely. "Shit happens in a battle."
Usanas, plain to see, wasn't a happy man, but he made no further protest. What counter-argument could he advance? Antonina had just pronounced the oldest of all veteran wisdoms.
Shit happens, Matthew and Leo echoed, like a Greek chorus.
Antonina saw Gersom grow tense. 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 She held her breath. She couldn't see a blessed thing forward, but she knew the line of 12 Aksumite ships had almost met the 15 Malwa vessels charging toward them. By now, the enemy would be up to full ramming speed. Held her breath. Held her breath.
Relax, said Usanas.
He seemed as stolidly serene as a lump of granite.
O ye of little faith, Malwa galleys in an open fight at sea against Aksumites?
He raised his head like a wolf baying at the moon. That cry of derision blended into Gersom's sudden shouting command. Within a minute, both the derision and the stolid serenity proved justified. And Antonina, once again, made a solemn vow not to meddle in the affairs of professionals. Gersom timed the order perfectly. The Malwa galley, driving straight upon them, bow against bow, was within yards of a collision. The Ethiopian warship, with experienced rowers and steersmen, suddenly skittered aside. Then, at Gersom's new command, drove it forward in a quick lunge. And then, new command bellowed, the rowers on the ship's starboard side lifted their oars straight up in a quick and coordinated motion. The maneuver was a perfectly executed dieckplus, as the tactic was called by the Rhodians, who were the Mediterranean's finest naval forces. Disaster struck their Malwa opponent. The captain of that ship, as was true of all Malwa captains, was inexperienced in sea battle. Inexperienced, at least, against a real navy. As powerful as the Malwa Empire was, it rarely faced a challenge at sea from other kingdoms. The principal duty of the Malwa Empire's navy was to protect its merchant ships against pirates. Arrogance and brute force are a splendid way to deal with pirates. They are poor methods, however, against one of the finest navies in the world. The Malwa ship came driving in at full ramming speed. The Malwa captain, seeing that his opponent's vessel had no ram, was almost chortling with glee. He would split the enemy's prow in half, back away, and then finish them off with rockets. Once crippled, the enemy craft would no longer be able to hide behind that bizarre and infernally effective shield. At the last possible moment, the Malwa captain ordered his rowers to slow the ship. No captain in his right mind will ram at full speed. The force of the collision might rupture his own bow. At the very least, his ram would be driven too deeply for extraction. Proper ramming tactics require a full-speed lunge to get within ramming range as soon as possible, a sudden slowing of the ship with back-thrust oars, then, in the last few feet, a simple collision. Ram splits hull but is not wedged. Back off, repeat if necessary. Good tactics, classic tactics. But the Malwa captain never considered the possibility that his opponent would know those tactics just as well, have long since determined the proper counter, and have a captain and rowers and a steersman who were far superior to himself and his crew. At Gersom's command, the Ethiopian ship sidled away from the ram. By the time the Malwa captain realized he was going to miss his strike, Gersom had ordered his ship into a forward lunge. The Malwa captain began screaming new commands to his confused rowers and steersmen. It was too late. The dieckplus was done. The Malwa galley drifted inexorably forward. The Ethiopian ship, oars raised out of harm's way, drove down the side of the Malwa craft not more than 2 feet distant, starboard against starboard, practically scraping the hulls, smashing and shattering every Malwa oar it encountered, which, given the Malwa crew's confusion and inexperience, was almost all of them. The Malwa galley, as a vessel, was instantly crippled. Even worse was the damage to the crew. The oar butts, flailing and splintering and hammering, killed only one man outright, but almost half of the Malwa galley's starboard rowers suffered broken bones, cracked skulls, and crushed ribs. All of them were bruised and stunned. All order and discipline in the vessel collapsed, as the shouting commands of the officers were buried under screams and groans. The portside rowers gaped at the scene, and then gaped wider at the sight of 2 5-inch cannon barrels approaching. Seconds later, many of those gaping mouths were swept out of existence entirely. Axumite Marines were pouring over the side before the smoke cleared. Again, the murderous cry erupted. To Akamariam! To Akamariam! The combat which followed lasted not more than 5 minutes. 6 Malwa sailors escaped by diving over the side. One of them, a good swimmer in superb physical condition, would make it to the bank of the delta several miles away. The rest would drown, sharing the grim fate of their fellow crewmen. In Karax's delta, Malwa would get no more mercy from Ethiopia than it had gotten from Rome and the city itself. Antonina, huddling safely in the hull of her flagship, clasped the hand cannon more tightly still. It wasn't fear which produced those whitened knuckles, simply horror at the sounds of unseen butchery not more than 15 feet away. Cries of fury, cries of pain, spears splitting flesh, sundering bone, soft groans and hissing agony, and death gurgling into silence. All was silent now, except the waves against the ships and grunting exertion. Silent, except for the sodden noise of spears plunging again and again into corpses. Slaughter made certain, and certain, and certain. Only once a low voice filled with satisfaction. To Akamariam.
I told you, said Osanas serenely.
Nikabe Tsensen, as had been true throughout the battle, had never so much as moved a hand.
O ye of little faith.
In the battle as a whole, Aksum suffered the total loss of only one ship. It was a grievous loss because the entire crew went with their vessel when the Malwa galley they were boarding suddenly erupted. What happened, no one would ever know. An accident, perhaps. Perhaps a fanatic priest. 5 other Aksumite warships suffered major casualties. Numbers will tell, even against experience. Not every Aksumite captain maneuvered as skillfully as Gersum. And with 12 Aksumite ships facing 15 opponents, 3 Malwa galleys were left free to strike where they would. Malwa's sea captains might have been arrogant and incautious, but they were by no means cowards. All 3 of those unharmed vessels rammed Aksumite ships. Tried to, at least. One of the Malwa galleys was so badly blooded by well-aimed cannon fire that it drew off. Drifted off, rather. Its captain and steersman slain, along with 1/3 of the crew. The other 2 rammed and then boarded. But the final result even there was the same. The Malwa advantage in numbers was not enough, not even if they had been doubled, to offset the experience and ferocity of Aksum's spearmen. The only difference was between a fight lost, badly lost, and an outright slaughter. At Usanas's command, the Aksumite line reformed and advanced again toward Karax. The city's harbor was less than 3 miles away now. Sharp-eyed Ethiopian lookouts reported that the Roman troop vessels were beginning to leave the docks. There were only 8 ships left in the Aksumite fleet. In addition to the one destroyed outright, Usanas had decided to abandon the 2 which had been rammed and 1 other which had been badly mauled. None of the 3 ships were in any danger of sinking, but they had been damaged enough to make them useless in combat. The Sarwen on the 3 crippled vessels transferred quickly to other Ethiopian warships, filling out those crews which had suffered heavy casualties. 8 ships now, not 12. But there were only 5 Malwa galleys left. Look at them, snorted Antonina, studying the enemy ships. And they say women can't make up their minds. Usanas grinned.
What you observe, Antonina, is a modern version of being caught in a myth between Scylla and Charybdis.
The commander of the Malwa inner squadron seemed to be torn by indecision. Or perhaps, as Usanas said, he was simply caught between 2 monsters. At first, the 5 galleys headed toward the oncoming Ethiopians. Then, seeing the Roman ships casting loose from the docks, they headed back. The principal assignment of those galleys, after all, was to keep Belisarius and his men from escaping. Then, seeing the first of the gigantic explosions which began to destroy what was left of Karax, the little Malwa fleet simply drifted aimlessly. What to do? What to do? The harbor area was as yet untouched by either flame or gunpowder fury. The Mawa Flotilla's commander knew that Belisarius would not set off the final round of explosions until he saw his way clear. But the rest of Kerak's a raging inferno. There had been naphtha mixed with the demolition charges. There was no possibility the oncoming Malwa army could reach the docks before the Roman ships were well into the delta, where the Ethiopian warships were within a mile of the inner squadron. They would reach the Malwa galleys in less than 10 minutes, long before the Roman troopships would be within effective rocket range. 8 against 5 now, and the flotilla commander had seen the carnage when the odds had favored Malwa. Suddenly, from the eastern bank of the delta, signal rockets flared into the sky. Green, green, white. Within 30 seconds, all 5 Malwa galleys were pulling for the shore, taking the only sensible course when caught between monsters. Get out of the way.
Will you look at them go? Chortled Antonina a few minutes later, watching the Malwa galleys scuttling eastward. Jason and his Argonauts couldn't have made better speed.
Usanas grinned.
Well, of course. What else can they do?
He pointed straight ahead. The view was open now. Already the shields were being removed and the pole framework dismantled. The fleet of Roman troop vessels was completely clear of the harbor, which was beginning to burn fiercely. A rippling series of explosions shattered the docks themselves.
To one side, Usanas announced, they have the famous General Belisarius leading his fearsome men. To the other, worse yet.
He began prancing about, lunging with his spear.
They face me. I was terrible, terrible, a demon.
Antonina burst into laughter.
You spent the entire battle sitting on your ass, fraud, imposter.
Usanas shook his head.
That's because I understand the proper place of a commander in battle, woman.
Scowling.
And what does that have to do with anything anyway? It's the soul that matters, not the paltry flesh. Everybody knows that.
He bared his teeth at the fleeing galleys.
The soul of Usanas, that's what terrified them.
A majestic, condescending wave of the hand.
The Samhain helped, of course. A bit.
Antonina began to make a bantering rejoinder when something caught her eye.
Someone, rather.
The nearest Roman troopship was less than 200 yards away. A soldier was perched on the very tip of its bow. A tall man, he seemed to be. And he was waving wildly. A moment later, Antonina was teetering on the very bow of her own ship, waving frantically, screaming incoherent phrases. Jumping up and down now. Usanas barely managed to grab her before she fell over the side.
Antonina, be careful. In that cuirass, you'll drown in 2 minutes.
Antonina paid him no attention at all. She was weeping now, from sheer joy, still waving her arms and screaming, and still jumping up and down. Small as she was, and for all his great strength, Usanas had some difficulty in his newfound task.
Marvelous, he growled. Once again, I have to save a fool Roman woman from destruction.
Chapter 39. In the event, Usanas wound up saving the fool Roman general. When the troopship was almost alongside Antonina's craft, Belisarius, he was leaping about himself, hollering his own ecstasy, slipped and fell over the side. Antonina shrieked. Usanas, by main force, hurled her back into Matthew's arms.
Keep her here, he bellowed.
An instant later, Usanas split the water in a clean dive. He found Belisarius in less than 15 seconds, floundering about, gulping for breath as he tried to unlace his armor. Fortunately, the general was an excellent swimmer, and more fortunately still, was not wearing full cataphract gear. Had he been, Belisarius would already have been dragged under. But the half-armor was heavy enough and awkward to remove.
Hold still, snarled Usanas.
He tucked his arm under Belisarius and began towing him to Antonina's ship. Belisarius instantly relaxed, using only his feet to help keep him afloat.
Nice to see you again, Usanas, he said cheerfully.
Usanas snorted.
Tell me something, Belisarius. He paused for a breath. His powerful strokes had already brought them almost to the ship. How did you Roman imbeciles manage to conquer half the world?
Pause for a breath. They were alongside now. Eager hands were lifting Belisarius out of the water.
Personally, I wouldn't let you out of the house to fetch water from a well. You'd fall in for sure.
He got no answer.
The Roman imbecile was already in the arms of Venus.
About 10 minutes later, Belisarius and Antonina finally pried themselves apart. Belisarius winced.
You have got to get rid of that cuirass, he muttered, rubbing his ribcage.
He eyed the device respectfully. It's even deadlier than it is obscene. Antonina grinned up at him.
So take it off, then. You can do it. I know you can.
The grin widened.
Seen you strip me naked, I have. Faster than...
Hush, wife, commanded Belisarius.
He frowned with solemn, sober disapproval. The expression, alas, fell wide of its mark. Antonina's grin grew positively salacious.
Oh, sure, soldier, tell me the thought never crossed your mind.
That's just a cudgel stuck in your trousers in case you're ambushed by footpads. Belisarius burst out laughing. Antonina's eyes quickly studied the immediate area.
Bit primitive, she mused, but we could probably manage on one of the rowing benches, as long as you refrain from your usual acrobatics.
She cast a cold eye on the small crowd surrounding them.
Have to get rid of the spectators, though.
Tell you what, you're the general. You order them overboard, and I'll shoot the laggards. Her last remarks had not been made sotto voce. Rather the opposite. The small crowd grinned at her. Antonina tried to maintain the murderous gleam in her eye, but, truth to tell, failed miserably. The giggles didn't help.
Guess not.
The sigh which followed would have provided the world with a new standard for melancholy, if she hadn't kept giggling. Belisarius swept her back into his arms. Into her ear, he whispered,
As it happens, love, I've arranged accommodations on the troop ship. The captain's cabin, in point of fact, reserved for our exclusive use.
Let's get to it, then, she hissed eagerly. God, am I glad I married a general. Love a man who can plan ahead.
He sighed himself now. There was genuine melancholy in the sound.
Not quite yet, he murmured. Tonight, love. Tonight. But there's still work to be done.
Startled, she drew back her head and stared up at him.
It is done, she protested.
Antonina swiveled her head, scanning the ships which seemed to fill the delta.
Isn't it? Didn't you get everyone off the docks?
Belisarius smiled.
Oh, that's done. To perfection. Best planned and executed operation I've ever seen, if I say so myself.
For a moment, he seemed a bit embarrassed.
I'll have to remember to compliment Morris, he mumbled.
He drove past that awkward subject.
But there's something left yet. Something else.
His smile changed, became quite cold and ruthless. Call it dessert, if you will. Antonina was still staring at him in confusion. Belisarius turned his head. When he spotted Usanas, he motioned him over with a little nod.
Are you in charge? He asked.
Usanas grinned as hugely as ever.
Is not King Aeon a genius? Didn't I always say when I was his dewaze that the boy would go far, make wise decisions, especially with regard to posts and positions?
Belisarius chuckled. Did you notice anything odd in those last moments before our escape? Usanas spoke without hesitation.
The signal rockets. Those galleys didn't flee. They were summoned to the shore. I didn't understand that. I had expected them to launch a final desperate attack.
Belisarius' smile was no longer cold. It was purely feral.
Yes, that is interesting.
He said nothing further, but it only took Usanas 4 seconds to understand. Ekabe Tsensen swiveled his head, staring at the far distant piers where the 5 Malwa galleys were now moored.
It is well known, he murmured, that wounded animals make easy prey.
He turned back to Belisarius. Predator grin met carnivore smile.
Ask any hunter, Roman. The best way to hunt is from a blind.
Interesting you should mention that, purred Belisarius. I was just thinking the same thing myself.
Chapter 40. The Great Country. Autumn, 532 AD. On the day of the wedding, Kungus took command of all military forces in Deagiri. Rao, being the groom, naturally didn't object. Neither did the various envoys and military commanders from the many kingdoms now allied with Shakuntala. They were intimidated by the Kushan, first of all, but even if they hadn't been, they would have been more than happy to let him take the responsibility. More than happy. The truth was, the envoys were delighted. Now that they had had enough time to absorb the new reality and get over their initial shock and outrage at Shakuntala's unexpected decision to marry Rao, the envoys were quite pleased by the whole situation. Well nigh ecstatic, in fact. All of the kingdoms which they represented had been petrified by Malwa. Their decision to seek the dynastic marriage with Andra had been driven by sheer necessity, nothing more. They had approached the project with all the enthusiasm with which a man decides to amputate a limb in order to save his life. Shakuntala had spurned their offers. Since the decision had been hers, she could hardly cast the blame on them. If they hadn't been diplomats, they would have been grinning ear to ear. They had the benefits of an alliance with resurgent Andra, without the shackles of a dynastic marriage. If things turned out badly, they could always jettison Shakuntala in an instant. It wasn't as if their crown prince was married to the crazy woman, after all. So let the rude, crude, lewd, and uncouth Kushan barbarian take the responsibility. A low profile suited them just fine. The forces now under Kungus's command were huge and motley. Deagiri was as crowded that day as any city in teeming Bengal. Under different circumstances, Kungus might have been driven half mad by the chaos, but probably not, given the man's unshakably phlegmatic disposition, and certainly not under the circumstances which actually prevailed. His opponent, Lord Venan de Catra, commander of the forces besieging Deagiri, was not called the Vile One by accident. A different man might have been called Venan de Catra the Cruel, or Venan de Catra the Terrible, or simply the Beast. But all of those cognomens carry a certain connotation of unbridled force and fury. They are the names given to a man who is feared as well as hated. A vile man, on the other, is simply despised. A figure of contempt when all is said and done. On that day, the Vile One was as thoroughly cowed as any commander of an army could be, and everybody knew it. Venan de Catra's own soldiers knew it. Throughout the day-long festivities in Deagiri, the Vile One never emerged from his pavilion. His soldiers, from his top commanders down to the newest recruit, were as familiar as any Indian with what had now become a staple of the storyteller's trade. The tale of how a great Malwa lord's lust for a new concubine slave had been frustrated by a champion. Unrequited lust, no less, to make the story sweeter. Today that beautiful girl, once a slave and now an empress, would give herself to the man who had rescued her from Venan de Catra, right in front of the Vile One, dancing her wedding in his face, taunting him with the virgin body that would never be his. Not now, not ever. The Vile One in his pavilion gnashed his teeth with rage. Rage seasoned with heavy doses of shame and humiliation. His soldiers, who despised the man not much less than his enemies, found it difficult not to laugh. They managed that task, of course. None of them were so foolish as to even smile. Not with Venan de Catra's spies and Mahami Mamsa prowling the camps and fieldworks. But they were about as likely to launch an assault on Deagiri that day, as so many giggling mice would attack a lion's den in order to assuage a lord rat's wounded vanity. Kungus spent a pleasant day rubbing salt into the wound. He rotated all the various troops under his command across the northern battlements facing Venan de Catra's pavilion and the bulk of his forces. Allowing Malwa's soldiery, if not the pavilion enclosed Vile One himself, to see the full panoply of forces which were now arrayed against them.
By popular acclaim, the 400 spearmen of the Dekuan Sawe were rotated through no less than 3 times. Partly that was due to the exotic and splendid appearance of the Ethiopians. Black men from a far-off and fabled land, blacker than any Dravidian, sporting savage-looking spears and jaunty ostrich feather headdresses. Mostly, however, it was due to the crowd's glee at the sight of 400 bare asses, at Ezana's lead and command, hanging over the battlements in Mawa's face. Better was still to come. By mid-afternoon, the wedding ceremony itself was finished, and the bride and groom began to dance. Shakuntala danced first. By custom, the husband should have done so, but the empress had decreed otherwise. Shakuntala was a wonderful dancer in her own right, but she was not Rao's equal. No one was, so she went first. Not because she was ashamed of her own skill, but simply because she wanted the people watching, and the world which would learn from their telling in the years to come, to remember Rao in all his glory. Her dance, in truth, was glorious itself. Shakuntala didn't dance in the center square of the city where the wedding had taken place. She did so on the top battlements of the northern wall, on a platform erected the day before, after hurriedly changing her costume. When she appeared on the platform, the crowd gasped. Shakuntala had shed her elaborate imperial costume in favor of a dancer's garb. Her pantaloons, for all that they were tastefully dyed, bordered on scandal. Yet the crowd was pleased. At first, as she began her steps, they assumed that Shakuntala was simply taunting her enemy, prancing in all her youth and beauty before the creature who had once dreamed of possessing her, which, of course, she was. Dancing, by its nature, is a sensuous act. That's as true for an elderly man or a portly matron, creaking and waddling their way through sober paces, as it is for anyone. But there is nothing quite as sensuous, dancing as a young woman as agile as she is beautiful. Shakuntala was both, and she took full advantage. It was well for Vainandakatra that he never saw that dance. The vile one would have ground his teeth to powder. But as Shakuntala's dance went on and transmuted, the crowd realized the truth. Taunting her enemy was a trivial thing, amusing, but soon discarded. The Empress Shakuntala wasn't dancing for the vile one. She wasn't even dancing for Andra. She was dancing for her husband now. The sensuousness of that dance, the sheer sexuality of it, was not a taunt. It was a promise and a pledge, and most of all, nothing but her own desire. They had wondered, the great crowd. Now they knew the truth. Watching the bare quicksilver feet of their empress flashing in the wine of her beloved's heart, they knew. Statecraft, political calculation, even duty and obligation were gone, as if they had never existed. Andra had married the great country, not because its own past required the doing, but because that was the future it had chosen freely. The future that it desired. When she finished, in defiance of all custom and tradition, the crowd burst into riotous applause. The applause went on for half an hour. It was Rao's turn now, and the crowd fell silent. His reputation as a dancer was known to all Marathas, but most of them had never seen it with their own eyes. They saw him now, and never forgot. The tale would be passed on for generations. He began as a husband. And if his dance was not as purely sensual as Shakuntala's had been, no one who saw it doubted his own heart. The dance went on, and as it went, slowly transformed a man's desire for a woman, the life she would give him, the children she would give him, into a people's desire for a future. It was Maharashtra's dance now. The great country was pledging its own troth. Love was there, along with desire, but there was also courage and faith and hope and trust and determination. Maharashtra danced to its yet unborn children as much as it danced for its bride. It was a husband's dance, not a lover's. Every step, every gesture, every movement carried the promise of fidelity. Then the dance changed again. The crowd grew utterly still. This was the great dance, the terrible dance,
The long-forbidden but never-forgotten dance. The dance of creation. The dance of destruction. The wheeling, whirling, dervish dance of time. There was nothing of hatred in the dance, no longer. Love, yes, always. But even love receded, taking its honored place. This was the ultimate dance which spoke the ultimate truth. That truth danced for all to see, held the crowd spellbound. Silent, but not abashed. No, not in the least. Every step, every gesture, every movement carried the great promise. The crowd, understanding the promise, swelled with strength. Empires are mighty. Time is mightier still. Tyrants come, tyrants go. Despots tread the stage, declaiming their glory. And then time shows them the exit. People alone endure and endure. Theirs alone is the final power. No army can stand against it. No battlements hold it at bay. It was over. The dance was done. A husband, taking his bride by the hand, led her into the chamber of time. The people, watching them go, saw their own future approaching. Once in the chamber, Rao's surety vanished. There was nothing left now of the superb dancer who had paced his certain steps. Stiff as a board, creaking his way to the bed, his eyes unfocused, Rao seemed like a man in a daze. Shakuntala smiled and smiled. Smiling, she removed his clothes. Smiling, removed her own. "Look at me, husband," she commanded. Rao's eyes went to her. His breath stilled. He had never seen her nude. His mind groped, trying to wrap itself around such beauty. His body, rebelling against discipline, had no difficulty at all. Shakuntala, still smiling, pressed herself against him, kissing, touching, stroking. His mind, locked tight by years of self-denial, was like a sheet of ice. His body, now in full and wild revolt, felt like pure magma. "You made a pledge to my father once," Shakuntala whispered. "Do you remember?" He nodded, like a statue. Shakuntala's smile became a grin. She moved away, undulating, and spread herself across the bed. Rao's eyes were locked onto the sight, yet his mind still could not encompass the seeing. "You have been neglectful in your duty, Rao," Shakuntala murmured, lying on the bed. "Teach her everything you know. That was my father's command." She curled, coiled, flexed. "I never taught you that," Rao choked. Arched, stretched. "Liquid, smiling. Moisture,